Morning, we were introduced to a new character in the book of Esther. We've seen a variety already thus far in our study. King Ahasuerus, who was the egotistical king of the Persian Empire. Mordecai, who is the principled Jew living as a part of these who are exiled within the region. We looked at Esther, who's the beautiful Jewish girl who's now been chosen to be queen after King Ahasuerus kicked his wife Vashti out of the kingdom for not listening to what he thought she should do. And now we come across Haman. Haman is the evil villain of the story. In verse 1, he was promoted to second in command of the Persian Empire. But not only did we learn of his promotion, we also learned of why Mordecai refused to give him reverence in verses 2 through 4, particularly that Mordecai was a Jew and Haman was a descendant of Agag, who was the king of the Amalekites, a people that we pointed out this morning who were notorious for their hatred and hostility toward God's people. We asked and answered the question today, why do the people of God experience so much hostility and hatred in this world? And of course, as we laid out, it is the result of spiritual warfare, Satan, particularly his desire to wound God by destroying his people. It is what he has tried to do since the creation of the first man and the first woman. For Satan knows that he cannot destroy God. And so what is Satan's objective? To destroy those who are nearest to the heart of God. And that is his people, his creation. And as we saw, his own son, the Lord Jesus Christ. Additionally, we were reminded of what Jesus said about even our own receiving of hostility in this world. How that even today, as modern day people of God, that we will face hatred, that we will face resistance, that there will be a great deal of hostility. In fact, we went as far as even to say that we should be surprised, even alarmed, if we claim the name of Jesus to be Christians and not receive just the slightest bit of pushback for living our lives dedicated to Jesus. And why should we not be surprised? Because Jesus himself said, if the world hate you, and it's not if as if to suggest they might know. No, he's issuing a statement that when the world hates you, know that it hated me before it ever hated you. And that's what Esther 3 is all about. The continued difficulty of living between two worlds, belonging to one while experiencing hostility in living in another. Such was the case for Esther and Mordecai and the Jewish people as they were in exile in the Persian Empire, and such is the case with those of us who are genuine followers of God. We do not belong to this world. We belong to the world to come, and because of that, we are faced with this great difficulty of belonging to another while living in this one. So to recap, we looked at, first of all, this controversial promotion in the first four verses of Esther chapter 3. We move on to point number 2, which is there in your notes, an evil hatred. An evil hatred. So immediately upon hearing that Mordecai, an officer of the king's court, refused to pay reverence to Haman, as we see here in verse number 5, Haman's anger is provoked. Notice again what it says. And when Haman saw that Mordecai bowed not, nor did him reverence, then was Haman full of wrath. I find it very interesting, the parallels that are striking between he and his employer. Because like King Ahasuerus, when even one person refuses to honor him, to do what he has asked them to do. He is infuriated. And that's the picture that we have not only of King Ahasuerus, who kicked out his own wife for not doing as he suggested that she ought to do, but now he goes and hires someone exactly like him who has the temperament just as he does. And now when one man, Mordecai, does not pay him reverence and respect, he is full of vengeance. But the irony here is that it gets worse, because his anger in verse number 6 explodes into this campaign, not only to destroy Mordecai, who is a Jew, but destroy all the Jews. After all, it may be very well that Haman, as it is others, are discovering for the first time that after many, many Jews had already went back to Jerusalem after this exile, that living among them were Jews and they didn't even know it. There's this great hatred toward them, hostility, evil. Look at verse 6. And he thought scorn to lay hands on Mordecai alone. In other words, he wasn't satisfied to just kill Mordecai. No. Haman sought to destroy all the Jews throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus, even the people of Mordecai. So now, to whatever degree the Jews living in Persia were trying to hide their identity, that cover was now over. He's been exposed, Mordecai and his people. Of course, Mordecai has acknowledged himself to be a Jew in verse number 4, and shortly thereafter, the remaining Jews are no doubt revealed. But here's what we need to understand about the heart of Haman. And I want you to listen carefully. As long as there exists one person who chooses to honor the God of the Jews instead of giving honor to Haman, he will not be satisfied. And when you go from this anger being poured out to one individual to now spreading into this campaign to destroy all the Jews alone, I wrote down in my notes that this is the epitome of an overreaction. One person defies you, and now you hold all of their kind accountable. By the way, aren't those extremes played out even in our own culture? One bad apple, and I'm not suggesting that Mordecai was, but perception-wise, one bad apple, and now we want to get rid of the whole bunch. That's Haman's mindset, and it's evil. And it's filled with hostility. This is what hostility to an extreme looks like. We will not be satisfied until we eradicate all of them who oppose us. But Haman has a hurdle to cross, because he's only second in command. He doesn't have the full authority to go ahead and decree this and carry it out. No, he's got to convince King Ahasuerus. So this is what he does in verse number 7. And I wrote a couple of things in my notes, perhaps that you'd like to write down just to help you in your study further of the passage. I wrote this down. He uses a game. He uses a game to determine when the Jews ought to be killed. Isn't this fascinating? Look at verse 7. In the first month, that is the month of Nisan, in the 12th year of King Ahasuerus, they cast pur. Now, pur is dice. In the old Babylonian period, astronomers would even gather with others and roll this type of dice to determine what the gods of astrology would have them to do. And so what's interesting here is that in verse 7, this man that is filled with evil and vengeance and hatred, he now positions himself to think in spiritual terms. Now, we know not true spirituality, as in this was no act of faith. This was pure superstition. This was Haman's diabolical way of tapping into the spirit world with the guidance of astronomers to try to dictate when the gods of the stars would want him to destroy the Jewish population. Does anybody see what is wrong with this? That not only is it filled with so much hatred, but he's trying to justify his cause by playing some spiritual game. I remember the days, as far as reading of history, I'm not this old, that the Nazis during that time would claim their anti-Semitism against the Jews as a religious one. They were just doing the work of God and defying those who in their terms had put Jesus on a cross. You can read it for yourself. It's there. So much evil and hatred and hostility, yet attempting to justify it as in a spiritual act. And so they put the lives of men and women and little boys and girls in this game of dice. And it's by this process that they determined when they should be killed. That's why we're giving some dating here in verse 7. In the month of Nisan, in the 12th year, this is about 5 years after the queen was initially kicked out. Esther has been a part of this for a little bit of time now. And so this is all unfolding a little bit in slow motion. And from day to day, it says in verse 7, Haman would gather with these astrologers and they would play this game. And we're not quite sure exactly how the game was played. It obviously took some time. But when it was over, it determined that they should basically be killed a year from that point. So again, this whole idea of destroying the Jews was going to take a little bit of time. And so now he goes, and this was the second thing I wrote, is not only does he use a game to determine when the Jews ought to be killed, I wrote this down, he then approaches the king in a deceptive manner regarding his truest intentions. He approaches the king in a deceptive manner regarding his truest intentions. Look at verse number 8. Haman said, and the king is where us? There is a certain people scattered abroad and dispersed among the people in all the provinces of the kingdom. I want you to pay very attention to what he's saying, and I want you to make judgment upon this yourself. Their laws are diverse from all people. Neither keep they the king's laws. Therefore, it is not for the king's profit to allow them to live. This is a lie. You notice what he's doing here? If anything, the Jews might have been more disobedient to God's laws than Persia's. The very fact that they've been able to hide their identity for this amount of time suggested that they were not following the laws of Moses as given to them in the Pentateuch. The fact that Mordecai would say to Esther, don't let them know you're a Jew. The fact that Esther was included in the harem, went before the queen. She's been queen of the kingdom and nobody knows she's a Jew. How does that happen? By not following God's law. So to suggest that they would not keep the Persian law is not true. And Haman does what all manipulators do. He starts with a truth. He merges it into a half-truth. And then he concludes it with an outright lie. That's what a manipulator will do to you. What did I just say? A manipulator. What's a manipulator? I don't know what that is. Whatever they are, that's what they're going to do to you, all right? A manipulator. Oh, boy. Sometimes I go home on Sunday night and think, why do I do this? I'm totally not qualified. A manipulator. They start with the truth. Their story merges into a half-truth. They end it with an outright lie. Let me prove it to you. And I'm not manipulating you. Look at it. Here's the truth. although exaggerated, by the way. There is a certain people scattered abroad and dispersed among the people in all the provinces of the kingdom. All right, a little exaggerated. The provinces of the kingdom of Persia are, as our president would say, huge. Huge. This is not Persia as we know it. This is over here from India all the way over next to Greece. This is a massive kingdom. It was a little exaggeration to suggest that there was a people not like them scattered in every province. It's not true. There was a people scattered among them, but not in every province. But we'll at least say for now, okay, there's your truth, Haman. We'll give you your truth, okay? There are people scattered. But then it merges into a half-truth. Notice this. He says next that their laws are different from us. Neither keep they the king's laws. Now, they do have their law from God. And we know what it is. But Haman is suggesting by this statement that they're going to create an insurrection. That as whereas you need to understand that they're doing their own thing. And this is a mob of people that if you're not careful, they're going to take their laws and they're going to fight against your kingdom because they don't like what your laws say. They want their laws. They're going to take over this place as whereas. But there's the half-truth. They do have a different law, the law of God, but it was not being used by them for an insurrection. But that's what manipulators do. They'll give you whatever bit of truth to help you believe it, but then they're going to throw in their own twist to convince you to second guess your opinion on the matter. And then he just outright lies, but read it a moment ago, neither keep they the king's laws. Is that true? No. Esther didn't resist the harem. That was one of the things that we scratched our heads about last week, right? Why didn't she? We don't know, really. But her obeisance to it shows us that she was keeping the king's laws. And what about Mordecai? Mordecai had been loyal to the king. He saved his neck, figuratively and literally. He had shown himself fully loyal. Esther, too. But Haman is bent on one thing. His hatred for the Jews will not be quenched until they are destroyed. And I'm going to tell the king whatever I have to tell him to convince him to let me do it. There is a great convicting truth about what's happening here. And it necessitates some self-examination in all of our lives. I hope you're not filled with hatred tonight. I hope an evil heart does not define your soul. Because hatred, as we see, will lead you to do some evil things, to persuade the opinions of others and gain their support. That's why we ought to be careful about the news we hear and the news we believe. Because evil does anything and everything to get its way. He uses a game. He reverts to spiritual lingo. He deceives the king about his truest intentions. There's no insurrection. There's no people disloyal to him. But Haman wanted him to believe it. I wrote this third thing down. It's not in the outline, but just some notes here in the column of my Bible. He concludes his speech by offering to financially support the endeavor. This guy is good. You know, why does it surprise us that Haman's a politician? I mean, this guy fits the bill. Notice what he says in verse number 9. If it please the king, let it be written that they may be destroyed, and I will pay 10,000 talents of silver to the hands of those that have the charge of the business to bring it into the king's treasury. This is simple bribery. And it shows us by this amount of money that Haman was apparently a wealthy man. Because to do something like this, he is suggesting that it would cost a great deal of money and it would hurt the economy of Ahasuerus. So he already knew, calculating this ahead of time, that to suggest the destruction of a people would not be a good political thing financially for the king. So Haman had this plan. Don't worry, king. We won't suffer financially. In fact, I have the resources to ensure we won't experience loss. Trust me. You do this, I'll write the check, and we won't lose a dime. Now, my study of trying to determine how much money this was, just to get a good idea, I've read that this amount of money is equivalent in verse 9 to about 60% of the entire tax revenue of the Persian Empire during this day. That's a lot of money that one man is willing to put into the treasury to ensure Haman, hey, I promise you, whatever loss you think you might incur, I'll make sure that doesn't happen. This is how much we need to destroy them. It's sad. Because the enemies of God will do whatever it takes to satisfy their hatred. And so we see a controversial promotion in verses 1 through 4. We see an evil hatred in verses 5 through 9. But write down number 3 there in your notes, an out-of-touch leader. An out-of-touch leader. This begins in verse 10, and perhaps we've seen this already. After all, it appears that King Ahasuerus spends most of his time partying, drunk, and feeding his immoral appetite. It should not surprise us that he is so out of touch with his kingdom and the activity that is taking place even in his own palace. But these verses bring that even more so to the surface. For one, notice it in verse 10, Ahasuerus abdicates his responsibility. Verse 10 says, and the king took off his ring. This was a no-no. You don't do this. The king takes off his ring from his hand and he gives it to Haman. This was the signet ring, by the way, the ring that authorized authority of the king. And so instead of Ahasuerus acting himself, he takes the ring off of his own finger. He passes it to another to use however he saw fit. This is terrible leadership. Terrible leadership. If he was going to allow something of this magnitude to take place in his own kingdom, then he should have been the one to put the ring on his finger and seal the document. Oh, but no. I'm not going to sign on the dotted line, is where it says. No, I'm not going to do it. In great political fashion, he only voted present, and he put somebody else in the responsibility. Is this not unbelievable or what? Does this feel like you're opening up the front page of the New York Times today? It's the same old stuff from century to century, generation to generation. He abdicates his responsibility. He takes it off. He puts it in the hand of Haman. Then Ahasuerus expresses apathy about the whole ordeal. Look at verse 11. The king said unto Haman, the silver is given to thee. The people also do with them as it seemeth good to thee. In other words, I don't care about the money. Just keep it. Do whatever you want to do. And guess what? That's what Haman does. Verse 12, the papers are written and sealed. Then were the king's scribes called on the 13th day of the first month, and there was written according to all that Haman had commanded and the king's lieutenants, the governors that were over every province and the rulers of every people to every province according to the writing thereof and to every people after their language. In other words, we're going to make sure everybody knows what's going on. In the name of King Ahasuerus. Oh, that's real proud, isn't it? Haman, this is your idea. But no. Let's not put my name on it. After all, it's all about the king, not me. You know, I'm just here to serve the king. A bunch of baloney. He wants to make sure nobody blames him for the ordeal. So make sure, guys, don't put my name. Make sure that you make it known that after the manner of King Ahasuerus, write this and seal it with his ring. And then he gives us the details in verses 13 and 14. This is the who, what, when, where, and why. All the details are publicized. The letters were sent, verse 13, by post into all the king's province to destroy, to kill, to cause to perish all Jews, both young and old, little children and women. I want it done all in one day. This is going to be a major slaughter. Even upon the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month of Adar, by the way, I don't believe it's meant to get read into this. And this is where a lot of Bible teachers can sensationalize the scriptures. But I do think it is at least worth noting that the particular date by which they chose to do this was the night before Passover. Just stick it back there in the back of your mind. Don't make too much of it, but you at least should know this is the night before Passover that they were going to destroy all the Jews. Kind of fascinating to me. And not only that, you're going to take the spoil for them of prey. So verse 14, they copy the writing and they publish it unto all the people. Notice the last phrase of verse 14, that they should be ready against that day. They're going to enlist the kingdom to help them carry out the job. It will be a total annihilation of God's people in one single day. Because an Agite discovered a Jew. And then finally, in this observation of an out-of-touch leader, we see Ahasuerus returning to his party in verse 15. This is crazy. The post went out, being hastened by the king's commandment. The decree was given in Shushan the palace. And the king and his partner sat down to drink. Think about that. You just approved the death warrant of thousands of innocent and vulnerable people who just so happened to be the very people of the Most High God. What is your response? What do you do next? I need another beer. Is this not insane? That you have no conscience? That you're promoting genocide? And you're going to drink up to the idea? And notice who's with him. Haman. And together over drinks, they celebrate the initiation of genocide in their kingdom. Evil. Apathetic, out of touch. You ever feel like that living in this world? That the people who preside over you are evil, apathetic, out of touch. Which leads us to why I wrote down finally verse 4. A city on edge. A city on edge. Now follow along with me. We've looked at a controversial promotion, an evil hatred, an out-of-touch leader. Finally, a city on edge. It's the very last phrase of the chapter, verse 15. But the city Shushan was perplexed. The city Shushan. He's not isolating to just the Jews feeling this way. The whole city is feeling perplexed, bewildered, confused. Did you read what they put out of the palace? What's going on? What's this all about? What have they done? Perhaps some of the Persians were even saying, if the king will do it to them, then what would keep him from doing it to us? What have they done that has unleashed so much hatred? You see, it wasn't just the Jews living in Persia who were confused. It was the Persians as well. And so often when you unleash hatred on someone else, listen carefully. So often when you unleash hatred on someone else, it doesn't take those closest to you very long to be wary of when that same hatred will be cast upon them. It's the whole principle of being reminded. If somebody is bold enough to come to you and criticize you or someone else, then don't take for granted that one day they're going to criticize you for the very same thing. And the Persians get it. That if their hatred is so strong against this scattered people, then what's going to keep them from doing it to us? Hatred, when unleashed, doesn't take those closest to you very long to be wary of when they are the next target. This is a city on edge. Wouldn't you agree? I wonder if there are people in your life and mine that are on edge by your presence, by your anger, by your hatred, by your criticisms of others. I know tonight that we're not talking about genocide. I know, I'm not foolish. This is not anti-Semitism in our room or a desire to murder. But we are talking about what Jesus said was like unto it. Hatred. Bitterness. Anger. A bad spirit toward others. It destroys marriages. It divides families. It diminishes the light of the gospel and Bible-believing churches. It disrupts relationships. Few things are worse than the tension and edge that is experienced by those who are filled with jealousy and hatred. That's why they were perplexed. Why are they saying this? Why do they feel this way? Can you believe what they're doing? And we're smart enough to know that they might probably do it to us. As people of God, we sometimes likewise experience this edge of which I'm referring to. We see things that are done to other believers. We hear of what the church experiences in persecution, among other places around the world. Just today after the service, I received a text message from someone who was in the service this morning who said, "Pastor, I understand everything you were preaching because that is exactly what happened to us. We are hated for following the gospel, our own family." We live with that edge. Policies are enacted by our own government places that cause the children of God to be perplexed at what might be coming next. And those of you who I won't say are much older, but much more wiser and mature and have lived a lot longer than some of us others might look at your life today and what is going on around us and think, I would have never dreamed 20, 30 years ago that what's coming out is coming out. What's going to happen next? What freedoms are God's people going to be removed from next? Who are they going to silence next? What laws are going to be established next that what we're doing in this building tonight won't be able to be done again on this soil? That's why we watch things and hear things and observe things and we're a little on edge about it. And I want to close with this question. What do we do when the world hates us who follow God? How do we respond in such hostility? Write these three things down in your concluding notes. Number one, here's the first thing you need to do when the world hates you. Number one, write it down. You ready? It's not on the notes. It's not on the screens. You have to write it down. Listen. What do I do when the world hates me for following Jesus? Number one, here it is. Don't be surprised. Don't be surprised. Listen to what Jesus said. Marvel not, my brethren, when the world hates you. Don't be surprised my brothers, my sisters, my followers, when the world hates you? That's the first thing we need to do. Don't be surprised. Jesus guaranteed that it was going to happen. Here's the second thing we need to do. When the world hates me, I need to be happy in Jesus. Be happy in Jesus. Jesus said in the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew 6:22, "Blessed, happy are ye when men shall hate you." What? Happy am I when they love me. Happy am I when they praise me. Happy am I when they recognize me. That's what brings me happiness. No, Jesus said, you be happy even when they hate you. In other words, you don't let the devil and this world and the enemies of God rob you from the only thing that Jesus can give, and that is true joy and peace and happiness in living a life for him. Happy in Jesus. The book of Philippians was written by the Apostle Paul. It's a dissertation on what? Joy. And you know where he was when he was writing it? In prison. For preaching the gospel. And the whole book is about having joy in trials. Peter, who was hung upside down for following Jesus, said in his epistle, "Beloved, think it not strange concerning the trials which come and happen to you, but rejoice, inasmuch as you are partakers of Christ's suffering, that when his glory shall be revealed, ye may be glad with exceeding joy." Peter said, be happy that you count it worthy to suffer along with the name of Jesus. For you have what they do not have. And they're gloating. And their pride and their arrogance, it's temporary. But what you have in Jesus is everlasting. Be happy in him. Be happy in him. He's still on the throne. He's in control. This is a story, Esther, of God's providence, which means he is allowing and he is appointing everything that's happening. God is in charge of this. Be happy with the one who's in charge. Here's a third thing you need to do. Don't be surprised. Be happy in Jesus. Keep doing good to others. Keep doing good to others. Apostle Paul said, when you do good to others who hate you, you heap coals of fire upon their head. It's a testimony that you have something they don't have. And if they want their life to be changed, they need what you got. Let me say it to you the way that Jesus said it in Matthew 5:44, and it stings a little bit, but it's the truth. It's the words of Jesus. He said, love your enemies. Bless them that curse you. So tomorrow, when you're on your way to work and you're driving down that beloved 485 down the Ballantine Way, and the guy is honking on that horn like you've never heard him blow it before, and it just so happens that awkward moment, he doesn't turn behind you. In fact, he pulls up right beside you at the next stoplight. And he's giving you a look. And he's cursing you. He's saying things that you would only hear Gary Hastings say. You know what you ought to do? You look. Wave. Bless them that curse you. Oh, wait a minute. He didn't stop there. Do. We're old enough to understand there's a great difference between do and feel. He's saying, I want some action. I want some response. Do good to them who do good to you. Now, do good to them who hate your stinking guts. That's why it's hard. belong to another world? To know that when you live there that you can do these things? It's why it's so difficult to try to live that way here. Because there is a lot of cursing. And there are a lot of enemies. And there is a lot of hatred. But the Bible says if you're going to endure this hatred, you have to be happy in Jesus. You have to keep faith in the sovereign Lord, and you must do good to them who despise you. It's the only way you're going to keep sane. It's the only way that you're going to press on. Because if you turn and do what they're doing, it's going to get you. I would really like to press on to chapter 4 tonight because the story gets gooder and gooder. I say that intentionally for you English people. I know it irritates the daylights out of you. But it's better than the story getting badder and badder. They will hate you. They will hate you. But may God help us to rise up in strength and follow Jesus, to be thankful for his salvation in our lives, to endure to the end, regardless of what they do to us. Because the very same tree that Haman is now building for Mordecai to be hung on is actually the one he's going to die on. Jesus wins.